ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. A Royal Navy submarine recently broke the record for the longest time a sub has ever spent continuously submerged, 206 days. We talked to a man on the spot as the sailors came out to see the sun for the first time in nearly 7 months. He says the men were almost translucent. What are the obligations of journalists in horror zones to the people whose tragedies they report to the world, particularly as the world hardens its heart to their plight? So much exposure lately and so little change. Later, the journalist and media professor Kathy Otten speaks to us on the potential and the limits of humanitarian journalism. But first, to Canberra and Anna Henderson, chief political correspondent with SBS, on the last night of freedom, before she enters the cramped, airless conditions of the budget lockup. Anna, welcome to the show.
David, you do make me laugh. It's actually very comfortable in our offices for the lockup. We're not in that big room anymore. We're very happily in our own SBS office with, you know, access to water and food and a refrigerator and our own space. It's not as bad as people think it is anymore.
You have taken on the role of ruining things, haven't you, for me? It's been going on for months now.
I just have to set you straight sometimes.
Hey, so much has been leaked. Do you really have to go through the trauma of reading the budget papers?
It's been a pretty grand strategy from this government, I have to say. After many years of covering budgets, the way Labor has unfolded the narrative and the story, like the hard decisions, the kind of big moments before we've seen this document, you do wonder how much is going to be left to rifle through. But yeah, I do think there are still some really critical things in that document tomorrow. Yes, we know about the big cuts to the NDIS, and I don't expect we'll see a lot more to reveal in that space. That's subject to months of consultation. Yes, we know that the government is going to increase defence spending. We're aware of the big fuel supply plan that the government's pumping money into to increase the days of fuel supply that Australia has. And of course, we've had, you know, many little morsels, I guess, of information to help shape what might be in these big property tax changes. But what will be in those documents tomorrow that will be really essential reading is exactly how the government is going to navigate the changes to negative gearing, capital gains tax discount, to trusts as well, those kind of really challenging policy areas that we know Bill Shorten tried and failed to get public support for, that we know this Prime Minister didn't take to elections, but that now has decided must change. And with the big majority that he has, I think there are a lot of people within his party who were desperately hoping he would go in this direction. But at the same time, you know, a lot of critics who say if he was going down this path, he should have been up front when he went to voters.
Oh, sure.
And I think there'll be some interesting things in the migration space as well, not least the projections around migration figures going forward, but also whether or not there are going to be big changes to how the system works in terms of who is eligible, what types of skills Australia is looking for in terms of new arrivals. And I'm really interested to see what happens with the unemployment rate and the projections around that, given, you know, the economic conditions that we're in now, because that figure, when you extrapolated it, is people's jobs.
How, I wonder, can the party that once was led by Tony Abbott complain about broken promises. Remember that first budget? That Joe Hockey first budget that broke every promise they'd made in the campaign that brought them to power. Every promise.
Well, they certainly tried their reform strategy, and I think there were the pretty tough times for them as a result of what they put out to the public. But I think the difference here, even though there is a lot of criticism around, you know, whether any political party making big changes, do they need to seek a mandate? Like, that's still a big question. But at the same time, you know, the population is skewing younger in terms of the voter base. And every parent and grandparent is also looking at, you know, what's happening with my child and their ability to get ahead.
Yeah.
And it does seem that, you know, the polling is suggesting that the tables are turning a bit and people are feeling much more sympathetic towards that reality and wanting to see something change in the system. But how the government does it and how they address that issue without people who are relying on this money or who've structured their world around this money without making them suddenly feel incredibly worse off.
But they will explode. And we know that. They will explode. Any change to a tax regime that affects anybody poorly, those people will explode. And there will be a nurse found somewhere who has a private trust, two negatively geared properties, and a few other things, and the tragedy of her situation will be blasted across Australia. We just know that.
I mean, in the past, that's true, that there have been really big campaigns against any of these changes, and they have been extremely successful. But, you know, the government's taking this gamble now, thinking that the nature of the Australian population and the appetite within the Australian population has changed. We just don't know. As you say, once we get to that finer detail of how the grandfathering system will work, how quickly some of these perks will get cut off, whether or not there'll be a way to ameliorate some of that anger, and whether or not we'll see big campaigns against the government as a result.
Yeah.
We'll have to find out tomorrow.
The money will scream. But isn't Labor facing a historic moment tomorrow? The coalition is wrecked. The by-election, which we'll talk about in a moment, showed that the coalition to be in abject trouble. Labor has a historically strong majority in the House of Representatives. If Albanese's government cannot do something big tomorrow, then the judgment on them is going to be pretty harsh, isn't it?
Well, the build-up has been substantial. I mean, we've been very strongly told that this is going to be ambitious, that it's going to be the biggest budget that this government has handed down in the time that Anthony Albanese has been Prime Minister. So the Labor Party has set itself a pretty high bar in terms of what it's going to deliver tomorrow. And a couple of the economists that I was speaking to today in preparing my story tonight were saying, you know, the big question for them is how meaningful will these changes actually be? When you open those budget books, when you calculate up the figures, when you look at the way things may be staggered over time or impact on or means tested or impact in different ways, are we actually seeing the significant structural change that, you know, many have been calling for, including many economists, to try and rebalance the system in Australia? Or will it be more tinkering around the edges? So, yes, the government will be held to account for that. And it will have to deal, again, with all the scepticism, particularly from those cut-through economists that we speak to, that the budget is more and more of a document which includes a lot of massaging and off-budget measures, and it's much harder to really understand whether the government's making tough decisions or not, because they can move things around in those budget books. We do our best, we're aware of that.
And the rivers of commentary that we will be canoeing down. I am talking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent, SBS World News, about Australian politics. Now, Anna, the by-election along the river. Reassure me, if you can, that it was not coalition preferences, because, of course, they controversially preferenced One Nation above the independent, Ms. Millthorpe. Reassure me, if you can, that it was not coalition preferences that elected the One Nation candidate.
So I did investigate this today, and it does, as I understand it, according to the figures, that's not how it's gone down in that seat. The coalition preferencing system may have played a role. It certainly isn't the case that the independent could have won without the preferencing. Like she didn't get enough. She didn't get enough of the vote. So, but whether on, of course, the preferencing assisted in the two-party preferred outcome for David Farley, but One Nation was already very truly on its way to success in the seat. Like it was a resounding victory for him and for One Nation. And the preferencing, I mean, if you listen to, say, Labor, they say that the decision to do that preference deal elevated One Nation with legitimacy because the Liberal Party said, you know, we're going to give them some legitimacy by doing that. And on the other hand, you know, the Liberal Party says, well, we weren't going to preference what they describe as a teal. Well, Michelle Millthorpe was an independent, but what they describe as a teal over someone who is more aligned with our view on politics, because in their argument, you know, teals have voted with the Greens. So you know, the argument is when they're presented with that set of options that they've chosen to give One Nation their time. But what's also interesting is it does appear that there was a following of the how to vote cards, because we always wonder, like no one's forced to follow a how to vote card.
How disciplined it does are look people? Like,
I think we've got to be careful about what happened in Farrah being extrapolated across the nation right now. But I do, like, there were local issues, and I think you've picked up on that as well. You know, David Farley is a local, he's a local man. He's very well known in the sort of more regional parts of the electorate. They were essential to his win. Water buybacks has been a major focus of his campaign, but it was the same for the independent. They both wanted to see an investigation. They were both very critical of water buybacks.
Explain what a water buyback is.
Well, the government is running a system federally where you can buy water, can be bought back to put into the environment from farming operations. And it's just so hotly contested in that area. That's an area that was, you know, very well known for rice growing, for example, such a water intensive crop, and other cropping as well where water was really required. So this process, including the way that Labor has handled it, it's damaged communities because they have changed their makeup. People have left towns, and there are people who feel a lot worse off generally because you take that money out of the community and it means that shops aren't getting as much money. It just flows through a community when you cut off an industry or if you reduce an industry's viability.
And it has to be.
So that's just a red hot issue.
And it has to be acknowledged that it's very, very difficult for communities along the river to watch that water flow by that could be irrigating rice because it's there for the health of the river, for a wetland downstream. And they see that this is water that could be turned into money.
And the argument on the other side about the importance of the Murray-Darling Basin and protecting those flows is also a very big, and contentious argument.
But squabbles over water, it's not a squabble, that's wrong, major fights over water are going to mean nothing in the western suburbs of Sydney. So whatever advantage, and I would imagine quite a strong advantage it gave One Nation in this by-election, isn't going to count in a general election anywhere else almost.
I think we're going to be really watching very closely as to how One Nation approaches those outer suburban rim electorates, and nothing should be taken for granted here, because I speak to politicians in the Australian Parliament who hold some seats in sort of semi-regional areas that have somewhat of an urban electorate, but people who are, you know, again, having a tough time economically in a semi-regional community or in a regional place. And One Nation is getting a foothold. But as you talk about Western Sydney and those suburban areas, I wouldn't rule out the fact that there is a resonance that One Nation has with some parts of those communities that is already starting to get traction. This is not a suggestion about Western Sydney that began with Barnaby Joyce saying it during the Farrah by-election. At the last election, there was already noise around posts on Facebook and other engagements that suggested One Nation was testing the waters as to whether or not it would actually be able to speak to those communities and finding local people who might well want to take on the One Nation message, but be recognisably local in their communities. So while I don't think this is necessarily, you know, the wave that's going to take over politics across the nation based on one by-election in Farrah. Yes, we've had the result in SA as well. But I do think there's a legitimacy to One Nation now. Two seats in the lower house, one Barnaby Joyce moving over, now David Farley elected, first One Nation elected MP, which says to people, this is possible. You know, One Nation will now take that forward. And they do have, I'm told, a significant war chest and some, as we know already, very deep pockets behind them, including one of Australia's richest people, Gina Rinehart, willing to really fund this push for One Nation to become a really serious political force. And the Liberal Party is just tearing itself apart now because there are those who think, but you know, we've got to go more hardline. And there are those who think we've got to stop talking about immigration and playing in the same space as One Nation and move more to the centre.
But Anna, a party that does seem to be actually considering the notion of having Tony Abbott as its president can't be seriously addressing the need to change, can it?
Well, that is a matter for the party. And, you know, Tony Abbott is very revered within the Liberal Party. But I think there are also those, and some of whom were speaking in Canberra today, who are desperate to see the Liberal Party take a good look at whether or not it needs to make a significant shift in terms of the way it's signalling to voters and not go back to the politics of Tony Abbott, but move very much forward and away from the hard right of politics. And this will be the internal conversation. But we know from the makeup of the parliament that the parliament, in terms of the Liberal Party and the Nationals, sways very conservative at the moment because Teals and, you know, community independents have taken up seats that used to be held by more centre-right Liberal politicians. So it is an uphill battle for some of those politicians who are worried that moving closer to One Nation is only letting One Nation cannibalise the Liberal vote and making them less electable by sort of non-One Nation voters. That's the challenge Angus Taylor faces when he does his budget reply on Thursday, because he is considering, you know, unfolding even more of his immigration message. We'll see whether he goes ahead with that.
And we will watch Mr. Farley, the new member for Farrah, and see how long he stays with One Nation. 9 months, 10 months, perhaps, you know, well into next year. What do you reckon, Anna?
Well, he says Pauline Hanson is his favourite woman, and he had his wife standing beside him when he said that. So he is all in terms of, at the moment, his support for One Nation, it seems. And that crowd of supporters, when, you know, the news came in that he had been elected into the seat, I think, you know, he will be surrounded by this base of people who will be shaping him as a One Nation parliamentarian.
Anna,
you're right. Like, we've seen this story before, absolutely.
But we shall see. They never stick around. They so far have never stuck around. But we shall see.
Can I just say though, you know, when you're talking about a senator, when you're talking about an upper house seat, for example, that's quite different to a lower house electorate, because when you're in the lower house, you're going back to your electorate, back to your voting base. You are kind of demonstrably with a political party, as he is.
Yes.
So we'll see.
We'll see.
I understand the scepticism. There's a lot of history to back it up. I just wonder if being in a lower house seat makes it slightly different.
Anna, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live.
Well, David, it's always a pleasure.
I have been speaking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent, SBS World News. Coming up, 7 months under the sea in a nuclear submarine. On the Royal Navy website are the vital statistics of Vanguard nuclear submarines. Displacement, 15,900 tonnes. Length, 149.9 metres. Speed, 25 knots. Range, unlimited. These subs are old now, but one of them is always out there, submerged for months at a time, carrying about 160 sailors and an unknown number of nuclear warheads. Times journalist Josh Glancy was there with the Prime Minister and the First Sea Lord when one of these subs returned the other day to its base in the Firth of Clyde after a record 206 days under the sea. Josh wrote what he found in the Times and joins us now on Late Night Live to go even deeper. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Josh, an enormous amount of money is invested in the notion that these huge metal objects, 150 metres long, 16,000 tonnes in weight, that these enormous objects can remain undetected. How can we be confident of that?
Well, they've been doing it for quite a few years now. But the precautions they take to remain undetected are quite extraordinary. So, as you mentioned, this later submarine was underwater for 206 days. In that time, it doesn't give out a single communication. So it receives lots of communications from the UK. In fact, it's essential that it receives communications from the UK with all sorts of tactical information and other things. But it doesn't emit any signals, which makes it almost impossible to trace. It also proceeds for the best part of 7 months in this case around the deep sea at basically walking pace.
Yes, miles an hour.
Yeah, it would be about 3 or 4 miles an hour, although they won't officially confirm that, but no. It is walking pace. And so that, again, keeps it incredibly hard to detect because it's just so slow. And actually, if you go on board, I went to the gym on the submarine and they have some weight machines and some treadmills, and there are little signs saying, mines have ears too, no clanking. So you can't just drop your weights on the metal floor. So even on board, the sailors, obviously they will make some noise, but they're very conscious not to make unnecessary noises. So of course it is theoretically possible to detect such a ship, but they do take extraordinary precautions to avoid it.
What is this submarine or these submarines doing out there? Why? What's their mission?
Well, the mission can be summed up by a box that sits in one of the central rooms on the submarine. And when I was in there, I just couldn't take my eyes off this box. And in this box, it's a very ordinary looking sort of metal blue safe, really. And inside the box is are letters from the Prime Minister. And the letters say that in certain circumstances, either in the case of an order being transmitted or in the case of total lack of contact from the UK for a certain amount of time, here are your orders to initiate a chain of command and fire the nuclear warheads on our enemies. And it's just extraordinary to see those letters because you realise that this is, in this little box, is the sort of nucleus of what remains of our apocalyptic state power. It's all there in this box. And so obviously this fits into a wider geopolitical strategy. It's, you know, it's obviously under the American nuclear umbrella to a great extent. But it's also there because we, as the UK, need the ability to have that last resort, to have that power of last resort. And obviously we developed that after the Second World War. And we need to sustain it. And that's how it's done. You know, the French have airborne nuclear weapons. We don't have those at the moment. We just have these submarines. And the idea is that at any hour of any day, of any month, that power is out there at sea.
And you quote Starmer saying, the remarkable thing is that it is a direct order from him to the sub and that there are no intermediaries.
Yes, it's a very personal relationship. And David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister of the UK, spoke about this. When it's one of the first things you do as Prime Minister. You know, you win an election, you go into Downing Street basically the next day, and suddenly the deep state sort of welcomes you into its arms, and you have all these strange and terrifying obligations. And Cameron described the writing of those letters and the sudden chilling realisation of what the power of his office was really capable of. And Sir Keir Starmer, who I was with when we went to meet this later submarine as it came in off its mission, was also very conscious of the fact that this is quite a direct relationship because of its importance. It can't be an order that's given by an admiral or given by a defence secretary, it has to come from the prime minister, from the very, very apex of the British political system. And so Starmer's gone twice to welcome these submarines as they come in off these marathon missions. Partly, I just think he enjoys it. I think he finds it interesting. He's quite nerdy. But also because he's conscious that it is that personal relationship, and that letter from him sits in that box in that submarine, and the chain of command is incredibly direct. And so that awesome responsibility lies directly on his shoulders, and it is a direct relationship between him and the commander of the submarine.
But what about the awesome responsibility when the submarine has not heard from Britain for, you know, a considerable period, when Britain goes silent? Because, of course, it reminds us of the story of that hero of the Russian Navy, Vasily Akhipov, who during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was the sub fully armed with nuclear missiles and things, and it heard nothing from Russia. And its orders were to fire, but the captain decided not to, for which we are all immensely grateful.
Yes, and this is where it gets a little murky, because obviously they don't let you into the absolute secret of what chain of command is and what discretion the commander has over it. There are an official set of rules, but clearly, in any circumstances, these are human beings, ultimately, the prime minister, the submarine commander, whoever else is involved, and they do have to apply their own human discretion to these awesome decisions. And that, I suppose, is what's also a little bit terrifying about it, is that, yes, we have this system, and it's designed, it's really the ultimate insurance system, but at the end of the day, it is run by human beings, and the capacity for human error, or as you point out, human saviour in the case of Vasily Akhipov, is obviously there.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Josh Glancy, who is the associate editor of the Sunday Times, who was up in Scotland when one of these immense submarines returned to base after 206 days under the sea. Now, Josh, prisoners emerging from captivity are the subject of opera and of novels and of films. What do these men and some women look like when they come out of a submarine after 206 days of never seeing sunlight?
You know, it's an astonishing moment. So we're in this little tugboat. The Prime Minister is there, the Secretary of Defence is there, the First Sea Lord is there, and various other naval chaps and women. And we pull up alongside. It's early in the morning, and you just don't know what you're going to find, because there has been no outward communication from the submarine for 206 days. Obviously, they've been surfaced for about 24 hours at this point. So, you know that the thing is still functioning. But they come up, there's little police boats, armed police boats around it. And there is a group of sailors and the commander of the boat standing on the hull. They're very pale, almost translucent, almost otherworldly in their skin. And that they're standing there to attention, and the First Sea Lord says to the commander of the boat, he salutes him and he says, "Good to see you." And the commander says, "Good to see you too," at last, acknowledging just how long it's been and how long it's felt. And that's it. And then we go aboard, and we're the first people to see, you know, we're the first people that they've seen for 7 months. And you just don't know what tensions or difficulties or fights or events have happened to them under there. You do know that they operate within a very strict naval discipline and that they're there to do a job. I mean, what I found remarkably was mostly people in a very good mood. Obviously, a great sense of relief that they've made it in one shape, in one piece.
Yes, they're home.
They're home, and their family's waiting, and all the home comforts are waiting, but also intense camaraderie. You know, you can only imagine the sort of depth of the kind of bonds that you would create in that environment. People, you know, a lot of very young guys, to be honest, who are make up the bulk of the crew. Good sense of humour, and kind of really deep sense of togetherness and community. But it is very weird. You know, every time you turn a corner on this boat, there's a sort of very pale looking bloke covered in tattoos and a moustache, sort of sitting there looking slightly exhausted and odd. So it is a really, really strange environment. And one interesting thing is that They get a 100-word family gram from their family each week, just telling them news and what's going on. But the families don't break very bad news to them, because obviously you can imagine a bereavement or a breakup would be really, really difficult to handle when you're underwater in that environment. So it's at the very end of the mission that the commander calls in various people. He knows the news, but he calls in various people and tells them, look, I'm really sorry to say, your dad's got cancer, or I'm really sorry to say, one commander told me that his wife had lost a baby while he'd been at sea. I mean, and he said every time he'd looked into this guy's face during the voyage, he'd almost burst into tears because he knew this thing, this awful news that was waiting for this young man,
But all of
but he
it's
only
kept
saw him on the
back
last day.
until the last day. My God, that must be a terrible experience for some people. But Josh, I noticed a detail in your story, which is that the punching bag had actually got torn to shreds at some stage during during the voyage, and that seems a sad sign that there was a bit of aggression around.
Well, look, they have a gym, which I think is essential because obviously there's not a lot of other exercise. I mean, they don't breathe any fresh air for 7 months. So the gym is essential. The treadmill had broken down two-thirds of the way through the voyage, which was a slight issue. They have a huge collection of DVDs and films that they can watch while they exercise. I think the gym is really important, but the gym is, like many things on this boat, very surreal because it's in the missile room. So you have these ballistic missile casings, and then in between them are, treadmills and punch bags and things. It's a very, very odd,
So,
very, very odd environment.
you're having a bit of a jog between nuclear warheads.
Pretty much,
Yes,
yeah.
yes. Now, look, we have to discuss some basics here, Josh. Now, I note that Wednesday is usually curry night on the submarine. How do they keep the air fresh?
Well, yeah, so you mentioned curry night. I mean, the food is absolutely essential to this whole thing because morale is essential to keep these things sustainable. And these missions are going on longer and longer. Morale is absolutely critical. And critical to morale is food. And they all were incredibly admiring of the chef and his ability to, they can only take 90 days worth of frozen food on there. So after that, it's tinned goods and comestibles and that sort of thing. And he did wonders with that. And they have 4 to 5 meals a day because you tend to do 6 hour shifts on and off
Oh,
and
is
during
that
each
what explains? I was very worried about your mathematics because
shift.
you had
Yeah,
160 sailors on board, but 800 meals a day. And I'm thinking, what's happening here? But obviously, it's more than three times a day.
exactly. So I had a very long debate with my sub-editors about this,
Oh,
and
I can bet.
we had to get a confirmation from the Navy on this point. So to answer your question, clearly, digestion is a big part of the mission. There's a huge sewage tank, but obviously every once in a while, like a whale, they have to sort of expel sewage into the deep sea. The air on board is an extraordinary thing. It's everyone warns you. The Prime Minister said to me, he says you won't believe the smell, and you think, God, what is it going to be like? It's actually not awful. It's not that unpleasant, but it's a kind of deep, oily, sort of salty fug. So they obviously bring new oxygen into the submarine, otherwise they would all die very quickly. So they have something called it's what's called a closed loop system, and an air purifier uses electrolysis to basically take oxygen in from the seawater and feed it into the atmosphere to keep them all alive. So it's very unusual air, and I'm told that the smell doesn't come off for days afterwards if you've been on a long voyage. And one sailor told me that his wife makes him shower sort of 3 times a day for a week and after he comes home. But I suppose if you're living on there, you do just get very used to it.
Yes. Now, the 160 young people on board, sex. What do they do about sex? How's that handled?
Well, it's a very, very good question because obviously the mind does wander about these things. I didn't ask, if I'm honest. Their bedrooms are unbelievably claustrophobic. I mean, however small and crowded you think it is, go smaller. You'll get 9 or 18 of them in the size of a large broom cupboard, really. Officially speaking, obviously they don't
Josh,
smoke, they don't have sex. Unofficially, Who knows?
Who knows?
Certainly the mind does wander in that direction.
The mind, look, it's just the natural curiosity. I did adore the detail that they kept up to date with the football results.
Well, again, it comes back to this point that sustainability is critical on these journeys, and therefore morale is critical. And so they do get these sort of almost like sort of teletext readouts from home about key news events, what's going on in the world, and then all the football scores. When we actually came on board, we also brought a stack of newspapers with them. And that was an amazing moment, because for most of us, when we read the news, we've already read the news online. We already know what's going on to some extent when we actually read a newspaper. Yeah. For them, it was like a very old-fashioned moment where they jumped on the papers and thought, well, what's going on in the world? And it reminded me that this trip is almost like being a kind of 18th century seafarer, in the sense that your family don't know if you've survived, basically, until you get home. You're not able to communicate anything that's happened until you arrive home, if you arrive home. So I did say to one guy, oh, you know, he was devouring the paper. I said, is there anything interesting in there? He said, no, I'm a West Ham United fan, and I'd be better off staying underwater, because they are on the cusp of relegation.
Poor man, so, poor man. Yeah. But that comparison with 18th century voyages works both ways, doesn't it? Because is it so that the government doesn't know what has happened to the submarine? The government doesn't know if it's been holed or captured or sunk, or is there no way of the government knowing whether their nuclear deterrent is actually operative?
My understanding is that there is no outward communication at all. I did wonder at this myself, and this is where they get a little bit Trappist with you when you start asking questions about the sort of very specific nature of what goes on. My understanding is there must be some sort of protocol, and there are extreme scenarios where the boat can resurface. And so they keep a reserve boat basically almost ready to go in Scotland in case the boat has to surface for some reason. You know, God forbid the commander had a heart attack or something. I don't exactly know, but there are protocols in place. But the basic rule is no outward communication for the very reason, you know, for the first question you asked, which is how do they stay so undetectable? And it is, you know, it is the moment you start to talk is you start to be heard.
So they just don't necessarily know. And this is the only nuclear deterrent for Britain. Is that right? You don't have missiles on land, you don't have missiles in air, you have missiles under the water.
That's correct. And there is some discussion about whether we should look to expand our nuclear deterrent or change our nuclear deterrent. It's currently very dependent and interwoven with the Americans, although people will disagree over quite how dependent, but we certainly resupply it from America.
Yep.
So there is some discussion about, should we have an Anglo-French nuclear deterrent? Should we have an airborne nuclear deterrent? At the moment, this is it. And it is just this one giant, very slow moving submarine. And that's moving around the oceans. And that's our deterrent.
Josh, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's honestly, I can say, one of the most interesting things I've ever done to go on this submarine. So I'm very pleased to be able to discuss it with you.
Frankly, you're bloody lucky. I have been talking to Josh Glancy, associate editor of the Sunday Times, of a piece that he wrote recently, actually in the Times itself, about visiting a British submarine, a Vanguard submarine that had been 206 days underwater. Coming up, the ethics of reporting horror. In Gaza, Ukraine, Yemen, and downtown Minneapolis, journalists report the horrors unfolding before them, largely in the hope that when suffering is reported, the world will do something about it. But now it seems front-page stories of horrors don't work as they once did. In her new essay for the Aon website, Kathy Otten, journalist and visiting professor at Rutgers University, wonders whether journalists ought to be asking people to relive the horrors they've been through, and for those intimate tragedies to be broadcast to the world when there's less and less hope that any good will come of it. After living and working in Iraq, Kathy Otten wrote the book With Ash on Their Faces, Yazidi Women and the Islamic State. Her essay in Aeon is called When Trauma Becomes Trope, humanitarian journalism is a moral calling to document human suffering, but in practice, it's an ethically murky undertaking. Kathy joins us from the UK. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why ethically murky? Is it because we can no longer trust that reporting of these horrors will in fact do anything about them?
I think that's right. I think what I'm trying to explain here is the problem that we have as journalists when we try to invoke the worst suffering and then action doesn't follow from that. And this is a conversation that us journalists, as you know, have been having amongst ourselves in the bars and the cafes around reporting for many years, decades. And it's a problem that's unresolved. It's a kind of central tension in the job. And I'm trying to bring the reader into that because I think this issue has only got worse recently with the wars that we've seen. And there seems to be a breakdown between political engagement with crisis and the types of harrowing reporting that as journalists we're continuing to produce. And I think that that creates a kind of moral upset among the reporters who are on the front lines doing the reporting. But it also creates a distrust as well and a kind of cynicism among the reading and viewing public. I think that that's the problem.
I can't say that as a journalist I've ever been able to achieve any change whatever, but I've reported lots of things in order that it be on the record, in order that it be information that people might use if they wish to make change. Isn't that more fundamental than feeling, as we always do, pissed off that a great story achieves nothing?
I think that that is really important, to have things on the record, to have the information out there so that people can make the right decisions. I think that that is key. But I think with the war in Gaza, we did see a more fundamental breakdown in the trust between the reader and the viewing public and politicians, because it's one thing to have the information out there. But, you know, I think of the example of US politician Cory Booker, like just over a year into the war, he gave a 25-hour anti-Trump speech on the floor of the House and didn't mention Gaza even once. So I think that it's one thing to put the information out there, but when you feel that it's not even affecting the discourse and nothing's happening, I think those are the sorts of problems I'm addressing in this piece. But of course, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be writing about the horrors of the war and of the world. I still think that that is really important. But I think I'm trying to think through, is there another way of doing it? You know, and is it enough to invoke terrible suffering and harrowing events? And what does that mean for the people that we're reporting on as well? And what can we promise them? And what can we do as reporters when nothing actually changes?
Before we get to that question, let's go back to Gaza. Are you really saying that the reporting in Gaza, which has been a variable quality, but some of it has been magnificent, brave, truthful, wonderful reporting, has not altered the discourse? Really?
No, I think it has altered the discourse, but not enough. I think that's what I'm saying. I don't think people have paid enough attention. And I think that this also happens when the horrors are that extreme, people turn off. And you've probably heard this phrase before, compassion fatigue. I think that's part of what's going on here. And as journalists, then we need to address that and work around it and think, well, if our message is not getting through, is there another way to do it? I'm wondering where the disconnect is. And I think the reporting in Gaza and on other conflicts has influenced things. You know, you do see, for example, with Russia, you see sanctions imposed. With Gaza in the UK, we've seen some weapons exports licenses revoked. So some change does happen, but I wonder if we owe our subjects more than this. And I think that that's the issue. And also how to engage a public that then just sees the worst atrocities happening and kind of closes their eyes. I think that's what I'm thinking about.
Yes.
And
yes.
We've had the same style of humanitarian journalism for many decades now. So I think from my experience teaching journalism as well, I also wondered, maybe there's a new kind of stranger way that we can do this. Maybe that's for the next generation of reporters to decide, to kind of re-engage the imaginations of the public and to make the connections between the worst atrocities happening in other countries and the decisions made by politicians at home. Because I think that those the connection between those two has been lost.
Kathy, one more question from me about Gaza. Hasn't the reporting of Gaza transformed the attitude of the world to Israel? It's a huge transformation which comes out of that reporting.
I think it has, actually.
That's not nothing.
Yeah, no, that's not nothing at all. I think my argument is not that it's nothing. It has done everything, but weapons are still being sold to Israel.
Of course, it's not perfect. It ain't perfect. One of the parts of your essay that really impressed me was the way in which journalists, some, and I disagree with the sort of generalization that it's everybody, but many journalists view people who have been through appalling suffering almost as a product and not as people. How do you see we can be better at reporting the people who have been through hell?
I'd go back to my own reporting in Iraq and the book that I wrote about what happened to the Yazidi women. And for those that don't know, the Yazidi people in Iraq were massacred by ISIS, and then thousands of the women were enslaved into sexual captivity, rape, violence, children as well, whole families. So the worst things imaginable happened to these people. And then following that, they were left in refugee camps, displacement camps, sort of living in a horrible, traumatic limbo. And that's where I met these people and interviewed them for a book that was created via testimonies of what they'd experienced. And I think there's something about the power imbalance of coming into those places as a Western journalist from, a middle-class, comfortable background, encountering these people who've experienced the worst things that you can possibly imagine. And I think there was an instinct from me to kind of sanctify these people with innocence and to portray them as kind of angels and perfect victims. Other people have written about this as well. And I think that while that instinct comes from a morally good place and from the kind of colonial religious Christian backgrounds of foreign correspondency, which I write about, that's the problem for me as well, because I think when you sanctify someone, you put them on a pedestal and you stop seeing them as a person with contradictions, as you say, and as part of a story with contradictions, which is what's interesting for the reader. So the reader kind of turns off because they see this cliched portrayal. You think you're doing right for the person that you're writing about, but actually you're kind of moving away from them by trying to get close to them. And then I write in the article that the problem with this is that then you're no longer meeting as equals, as two people that might be able to change one another. So I think that journalism and foreign correspondency has had a superiority problem where we've not been able to get down in the dirt and think, okay, maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe I can be changed. We come in with our preconceived notions and then place them onto victims and portray victims as a kind of saintly class of people that we then need to patronize with our aid and our policy, instead of really actually turning around and looking at ourselves.
Kathy, aren't you describing good journalism and bad journalism?
I think that's true. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I think what I'm writing about is trying to kind of actually investigate the psychological heart of this problem and why it happens. Because I don't think it's just as simple as good journalism and bad journalism, because I think when you speak to journalists off the clock, you'll know that a lot of journalists, we have a complex moral understanding of these cases, but then that doesn't stop you doing bad journalism sometimes because of the forces acting around you. You can go in with the best intentions and these things can still happen. I think it's difficult as well, because then when we try to tell system stories and stories about corruption, stories about wrongdoers, sometimes that can move further away from the kind of the emotional frame of reporting that I'm talking about. So it's very hard to get the balance right between presenting trauma, between making an emotional case, appealing to the sentimentality of the reader, but then explaining a complex system in a way that's also not too dry and too boring, that's going to switch people off and they think, okay, well, supply chains are not my business, you know? So this is the difficult work and balance of journalism. And I think I'm trying to say, look, we are careful people and we're considering it and we're trying our best, but these are dangerous, murky moral terrain and grounds that we're swimming in.
Seymour Hersh, 1969, exposed Mylai, the massacre. People were sent to jail, American soldiers were sent to jail, even if only briefly. Do you think it is possible for exposure to work in the same way these days? Has an exposure of a scandal of that kind in the last few years worked that sort of outcome?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't think we've had anything quite meeting the standards of Hersh's investigation then. And I think one of the problems is that we have so much news and information coming at us and actually fantastic journalism being done all the time. And sometimes those stories just get lost in the post. I'm sure you're aware of that problem as well. We almost have too much to cover. So the media environment is completely dispersed. And then the good stuff gets missed because it's washed in all of the social media content and the bad. So I think that is a problem, not so much of the quality of journalism and investigations, but about focus and the way the news is dispersed.
What's your solution to compassion fatigue? That's a mighty question, I know.
I don't think I have the answer to that, but I want to have the answer to it. I mean, I think the simple answer, like, is what you've been pointing at as well, which is, okay, just good journalism, like the best that we can do, done really well, with the highest regard for the dignity of our subjects, and to see them in the most complex light possible, and to tell complex stories in a way that draws people in and engages them. But beyond that, I haven't really got any answers, but I do know that something needs to change.
Kathy, magnificently put. Thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Kathy Otten, journalist, visiting professor at Rutgers University, about her new essay on Aeon, and it is called
When Trauma Becomes Trope.
Thanks, Kathy. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. There are many ways to win pre-selection in the Labour Party. Assassination is not usually one of them. Yet ambitious Vietnamese politician Phuong Nho is still behind bars for the 1994 assassination of Sydney Labour MP John Newman, killed, it was said at the time, in order that Phuong could take his seat. Former ABC journalist Debbie Whitmont joins us next time to tell the story of Australia's only assassination.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.